of a particular situation and to begin to change practice in the church. I think his consistent commitment was to life, but he described that broadly. He talked about violence, the violences that were done to destroy life, that were multifaceted, as you said, beginning with war, with overt violence, with exclusion of migrants, and on and on. So he did not limit the church's understanding of commitment to life to only the issue of abortion, but stretched our imagination to understand that to protect life meant to promote a world of peace, of justice, and to find nonviolent ways to move into the future.
And women.
Yes, and women. Pope Francis, as is often the case, Pope Francis began to listen to women, to hear the experience of women, and he took some quite significant steps to move women into positions of leadership in the institutional church, very high-level positions, which was significant in the Catholic Church. He was not yet ready to talk about women's ordination or to make a change in terms of ordination of women in the Catholic Church. But he, especially during the very large synod process, where people from around the world were invited to share their experience and their opinions, he listened carefully, I think, to the insistence of women around the world that we needed to be fully a part of the leadership in the church. So some small steps in that direction, at least a door was open.
I wanted to go to Reverend Munther Isaac, Palestinian Christian theologian, pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem. Last Christmas, he delivered a sermon titled, Christ is Still in the Rubble. His forthcoming book is titled, Christ in the Rubble, Faith, the Bible, and the Genocide in Gaza. If you can talk about the Pope's stand as late as yesterday, hours before his death. He called for a ceasefire in Gaza. And of course, in the last year, has gone way beyond that, Reverend Munther Isaac.
Yes, this is, of course, a great loss to all humanity, and particularly to the Christian world, to the Catholic world. And we really lament and grieve his loss. And I think that Pope Francis's position on Palestine is just an extension of his theology and pastoral care in general, caring for the marginalized and victims of injustice. What he has done and exhibited and said throughout the war on Gaza was not the first time he spoke for the plight of Palestinians. I think the no Palestinian will ever forget when Pope Francis in 2014 stopped his car, went down, stepped down, and prayed at the separation wall separating Jerusalem from Bethlehem, a moment that touched all of us and continued to speak to us for years. And during the war on Gaza, I think he reflected two very important elements. First, his pastoral heart, his compassion. He spoke almost on a daily basis to the Church of the Holy Family in Gaza. He genuinely cared. He often even joked with them. He would pray with them, which reflect his heart of compassion. But I think his words also went beyond the standard pray for peace kind of language of many church leaders. And this is the distinction of Pope Francis, his courage, his always seeking to push things forward. He spoke, as we heard, on the war as terror, as cruelty. And I think one of the most important things he has said was in a book in which he called for investigation as to whether what Israel has committed in Gaza amounts to a genocide. To me, this is extremely important because it calls for accountability, and it shows that he's more than just compassion and peace. He's for justice. He's for accountability. And I think this is really what's missing from the language of many faith leaders. He was exemplary in that.
Now, you are not a Catholic, but talk about his effect on Christians throughout the West Bank and Gaza, on Muslims as well, as he pushed for more understanding of the Islamic faith, as he talked about migrants, and making this a centerpiece of what he said. It's very interesting, as he called for a ceasefire in Gaza yesterday, the same day that he met with the Vice President of the United States for a number of seconds.
Yes. It's important then to note that here is a Lutheran pastor speaking about Pope Francis as a leader for all of us, because he truly and genuinely reflected, in my opinion, the ideals of the gospel. He was a true follower of Jesus, and he exemplified, not just in words, but in actions, the teachings of Jesus. And as I said, he was truly beloved for us in Palestine, because he made us feel recognized in a time when many tried to ignore and dehumanize Palestinians. The way he spoke about Arabs, Muslims in general, I mean, even when there was attacks on the Christian community by some Islamic groups, he would make sure that we distinguish between, for example, what Islam says and what these fringe or radical groups do, warning from the dangers of Islamophobia. So he truly understood the danger of the polemic language that exists in many of our politicians today, and tried to be a bridge builder and fight stereotypes, recognizing that extremism exists in all faith traditions. And for all of that, as I said, he is truly beloved by many who are in the fringe, marginalized, and including here as well in Palestine. And I think you mentioning his meeting with Vice President Vance, I think it's important because in the coming days, and I'm sure we will hear so many good things said from politicians about Pope Francis, the very same politicians who would go on and ignore everything he taught and said, which is never new. I mean, we've seen the same happen with people like Desmond Tutu and others, for example, on the issue on apartheid in Palestine and so on. So it's going to be interesting to hear, to see hypocrisy manifested from the mouth of many politicians who will say all good things about Pope Francis, then go on contradicting many of the things he taught and sought to establish throughout his ministry, whether as a priest, as a bishop, archbishop, cardinal, and of course as Pope.
I want to go right now to the Pope talking about the cardinal, and then you can explain what happened.
Cardinal Ray spoke about the war yesterday. They did not let the Patriarch enter into Gaza as they had promised. And yesterday, children were bombed. This is cruelty. This is not war. I wanted to say this because it touches the heart.
Can you explain, Reverend Munther Isaac in Bethlehem, what took place last December?
I think the Pope was talking about the incident in which two Palestinian Christian women were shot and killed within the vicinity of the Church of the Holy Family in Gaza. When he said, you know, this is the church, there are no militants there, he clearly was in touch with the people in the church who assured him that no one was in the church campus other than the Christian families who escaped. And so he spoke with clarity, you know, condemning what happened and saying this is cruelty, this is terror, when two innocent women are killed by snipers in front, literally in front of the door of the church for no reason whatsoever. It shows that he recognized that this is not just, you know, as Israel always claimed, they're targeting militants, or that militants hide behind civilians and so on. None of that happened when the churches were attacked. And I think what happened at the churches points to the reality all over Gaza, is that innocent civilians are targeted under the cover or under the justification that, you know, militants are hiding there, whereas in the church, clearly no militants was there. And the words that the Pope chose, I think, were extremely important, whether cruelty, whether terror. I think all of these describe the hell that exists right now in Gaza. And I really wish more faith leaders speak with this moral clarity, describing what is happening right now in Gaza, rather than simply wishing for a ceasefire without calling things by name.
Reverend Munther Isaac, we want to thank you for joining us from Bethlehem. Reverend Isaac tweeted today, "I wonder, will the millions who will mourn his death these coming days respect this wish of his? Will they care for Gazans and Palestinians the way he did?" As we go right now to Robert Ellsberg, publisher of Orbis Books, editor of Pope Francis's book, "A Stranger and You Welcomed Me: A Call to Mercy and Solidarity with Migrants and Refugees." Robert, thanks so much for being with us. If you can talk about his approach to migrants, we're beginning the show with a senator who's calling for a migrant to be brought back to the United States, Kilmer Abrego Garcia. And we're going to end the show with a Palestinian Columbia student who's been imprisoned in Vermont. If you can talk not only about immigrants, but also about indigenous people and the stance that the Pope took, and talk about overall his legacy.
Yes, thank you, Amy. It was clear that the subject of migrants and immigrants wasn't just one topic among many that he addressed, as all popes might. It really was a kind of signature of his papacy. Very ironic that the two people who are most focused on that subject are Donald Trump on the one hand and Pope Francis, representing completely diametrical perspectives. But as Marie mentioned, he signaled that very early. The very first trip he made out of Rome was to this island of Lampedusa, which is a kind of way station where many through the Mediterranean and North Africa had tried to make it there, and many had died, drowned along the way, making, he said, the Mediterranean into a giant cemetery. And that was the first kind of speech he made outside of Rome. And it was directed not just about the suffering of migrants, but about what their condition reflected on the rest of the world, the comfortable world, and what he called the culture of indifference. He made a very pointed challenge when he referred to the story of Cain and Abel. And God says to Cain, who has killed Cain, who has killed his brother Abel, "Where is your brother?" And he says, that's the question that the immigrants are raising to us. He says, you know, who weeps for these people? In the culture of indifference, we're not even able to see our brothers and sisters as our siblings. And so that for him was an extremely vital test of the meaning of the gospel.
Talk about
that we could.
Robert, sorry, if you could talk about his beginnings. Talk about how he was chosen, the first Latin American pope, the first Jesuit pope, and also how he even came to take the name Francis.
That's also very significant. He came to Rome after the conclave, after the resignation of Pope Benedict. He was at retirement age. He was expecting to return back to Argentina. But instead, he kind of electrified the conclave, which is the meeting of cardinals where they elect the pope, by giving a very short speech of just a few minutes, where he said, the greatest problem facing the church does not come from outside. It comes from within, from what he called ecclesial narcissism and introversion, the church that's focused in on itself. He said an evangelizing church, a church which represents the gospel of Christ in the world, goes out to the margins and peripheries to touch the wounds of Christ. And that seemed to that won him the votes to become pope. And as the votes were being tallied, a cardinal from Brazil whispered to him, "Remember the poor." And he says it was at that moment that he thought of St. Francis. Now, no one has ever chosen Francis as a name for a pope before, for probably good reason. Pope for St. Francis associated with poverty, simplicity, the renunciation of power, etc. But it was very deliberate. And he said he thought of Francis as the poor man. He said, how much I would love a church that is poor and for the poor. And that became a signal of the agenda of his papacy, his concern for mercy rather than enforcement of rules and orthodoxy, his openness to the earth, his care for creation, reflected in his encyclical, Laudato Si, where he really put concern for the earth at the center of Catholic social teaching, his embrace of nonviolence and opposition to war, his friendship with Muslim leaders and leaders of other religious faiths, and obviously the kind of simplicity and spirit of poverty that he himself embraced. So all of those were very, very significant indications of what his papacy was going to be about.
If you can talk about what are the next steps, Robert Ellsberg, and also what it was like to edit the Pope's book, and then what happens now that he has died.
Well, the first thing that will happen will be a period of mourning and his funeral. Cardinals will be summoned to Rome from all over the world, and he has appointed about three quarters of them, and most notably cardinals from the kind of far corners of the world, places that were not usually represented in the College of Cardinals. So many of them don't know each other very well. They'll come together to spend some time together talking. And then they will go into the locked conclave within the Sistine Chapel and begin voting for a successor. People are now a little more familiar with that because of the movie Conclave. I'm sorry, your other question. Oh, about the experience of editing. I've been at Orbis Books for 38 years, which is a publishing house kind of concerned with global dimensions of faith in the world. We became well known for our publications of liberation theology. So for many years, we were kind of under a shadow in Rome, many of our authors being disciplined and silenced even. And when Pope Francis was elected, it was clear that we had found a pope who really reflected exactly our kind of understanding and mission of the church. So we published about 20 volumes of his writings and books about him on all subjects from war, the environment, the Amazon, mercy, the works of mercy, and my book that I edited on migrants and refugees. So for that, just recognizing what is a signature topics this was for him, I simply went through all of his speeches, writings, prayers, and found just an extraordinary riches in terms of his reflection on this. You know, the title, A Stranger and You Welcomed Me, comes from the text in Matthew 25, where Jesus describes the conditions of our salvation when he says, I was hungry and you fed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. When did we do this? Insofar as you did this for the least of my brothers and sisters, you did it for me. So it went right to the core of the gospel teaching for Francis about seeing Christ in our brothers and sisters, especially in the poor.
And before we go, in this conclave that will choose the next pope, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, called SNAP, announced recently the creation of a database known as Conclave Watch. The significance of this, Robert?
Well, obviously, one of the momentous crises facing the church over the last decades has been the scandal of sex abuse within the church, and all the recent popes have had to confront this in some ways. Pope Francis, I think, more than his predecessors, and yet still there were those who were critical of him for not doing more. So it will be, I think, certainly a question that will go into, it was a question probably not asked before. Anybody who could be considered for Pope has to have be very, very scrutinized over the questions, not just their own, failures as humanly, personally, as themselves are crimes, but they're especially as bishops who covered up the sex abuse of other priests. Or were not sensitive to the sufferings of the victims. So I think that will certainly be, for the first time, probably a critical question that will be examined in the conclave.
Finally, liberation theology. if you can address in this 1 minute, and we'll have longer conversations about this in the week, his connection to that and the elevation of liberation theology.
Pope Francis, as you said, is the first Latin American pope, also a Jesuit. He came from Argentina, which was a site of the dirty war and terrible persecution of dissidents of all kinds. He certainly was very familiar with liberation theology, didn't embrace that per se as a name, but he it's so much in the bloodstream of the Latin American church, and particularly the preferential option for the poor, which is something that he embraced definitely. He welcomed Gustavo Gutierrez, the kind of father of liberation theology, to come celebrate Mass with him in the Vatican. He canonized Archbishop Romero, and he made it very clear that the themes of liberation theology, insofar as they had to do with the option for the poor and the defense of those on the margins, and especially the reading the Bible, the whole church's orientation should be done from the perspective of those on the margins. So in that sense, he really brought kind of themes of liberation theology right into the heart of the church and its teaching.
Robert Ellsberg, I want to thank you for being with us, editor of Pope Francis's book, A Stranger and You Welcome Me, A Call to Mercy and Solidarity with Migrants and Refugees, also editor of Orbis Books. Reverend Mother Isaac, Palestinian Christian theologian, pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem, author of Christ in the Rubble, the forthcoming book, and Marie Dennis, a director of the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative of Pax Christi International. Next up, we go to an Israeli-American Columbia student who is fighting for release of Mohsen Mahdawi. He says, as Israelis in New York were horrified by ISIS detention of one of our Palestinian partners in peace. Back in 20 seconds.
Liberation theology. One of us suffers, one of us are free. Talking moral values, not about dignity.
Irish Catholic Boy by Shaunaki and the Unity Squad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Trump administration ramps up its attack on international students, we end today's show here in New York. Yesterday, a major protest in Union Square with Jewish New Yorkers and Israelis calling for the release of the detained Columbia student Mohsen Mahdawi, who was arrested in Vermont when he appeared for what he was told would be a naturalization test. He had previously expressed fears about the appointment, which came earlier than usual in the typical naturalization process, and he feared it could end up being a trap. So he wrote to all three legislators in Vermont, Bernie Sanders, Peter Welch, as well as the Congress member Becca Ballant. This is New York controller mayoral candidate Brand Lander speaking at the Union Square protest organized by Israelis for Peace.
This is somebody who grew up in a refugee camp in the West Bank, saw a friend be killed by an Israeli soldier, and yet rather than turn to vengeance or pick up a rock or a gun, turn to Buddhism, becomes a peace activist, and comes here and goes into synagogue speaking about empathy. So his friend, Josh Drill, was here today to speak about him and humanize him. And I thought it would be really important to come here, because when I heard about what happened to Mohsen, I was mad generically. But to get to know him a little through Josh, now I'm mad specifically, and that's the kind of solidarity we need a lot more of.
And this is the Israeli-American Columbia student who Brad Lander referenced, Josh Drill, speaking at Sunday's protest.
We cannot allow these deportations to happen. They threaten our future. Only together can we stop these deportations. Only together can we stop the bloodshed, and only together can we end the military occupation and create a reality of peace.
And Josh Drill joins us now, an Israeli-American peace builder pursuing a Master of Science in Strategic Communications at Columbia University, co-wrote a piece for The Forward, headlined, "As Israelis in New York were horrified by ICE's detention of one of our Palestinian partners in peace." Josh, we just have 3 minutes, and I know you have a meeting right after the show. Tell us who and how you know who Mohsen Mahdawi is.
I met Mohsen through a brave group of Palestinian and Israeli students at Columbia. We met for the past months weekly, having intense discussions, sharing our personal traumas, healing together, envisioning a peaceful future and what our place in that is. And it's really important for me to say that these deportations do not keep anyone safe. They endanger us. They endanger us because they separate Palestinian and Israeli peacemakers who are trying to change the reality. We need to continue having conversations. It's a matter of life and death.
And how did you come to know Mohsen? And also the fact that he's head of Columbia's Buddhist Association.
Yeah, so through the group, I came to know Mohsen, and from that, we began having weekly conversations and meetings. I remember specifically in one of our first meetings, Mohsen presented to the group a 20-30-slide PowerPoint presentation about his vision for peace, slide through slide, empathetically and thoughtfully explaining a way forwards. And this is at a time when he already knew that he was under threat of deportation. Mohsen, we're speaking about a deeply empathetic person. We're speaking about someone who understands that the peaceful resolution is a nonviolent resolution, is reconciliation, is collective healing. And I think that this deportation and the threat of it sends a chilling message that peacemakers are not welcome here in America.
You are a student at Columbia University, like Mohsen Mahdawi. What are you calling on Columbia University to do?
I think it's clear that they need to take a stand and not allow their students to be deported. They need to take a public position against these deportations, and they need to make sure that Mohsen next month can graduate his bachelor's degree. And this fall, Mohsen is supposed to start his master's degree in international relations. The university needs to do everything in their power to make that happen.
You write in your piece that the targeting of Mohsen is especially absurd, given his prominent voice in advocating for dialogue and cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians. You believe he was targeted clearly. In this final minute, what is your demand even beyond Columbia?
Release Mohsen. Stop these deportations. Allow this new generation to continue having conversations, to continue meeting so that we can build a collective future for ourselves and for our children. What Mohsen represents is new. And new can be scary for some people. But new on both sides of this conflict is exactly what Israelis and Palestinians need to end the conflict and to create peace.
Josh Drill, we want to thank you for being with us. I know you're going to a peace conference in Geneva today. Safe flying. Josh is a student pursuing a Master of Science in Strategic Communications at Columbia University. We'll link to your piece in The Forward. As Israelis in New York were horrified by ICE's detention of one of our Palestinian partners in peace. This is Democracy Now! To see our video and audio podcast, to sign up for our daily digest, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Woronoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
The SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, MAD, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca. Radio.